long time ago. It didn't work.
You talked to them, I said. It didn't get through. You need to find another way to get your message through. You have to show them.
You mean hurt them? Not necessarily, I said quietly. But guys like those two jokers only respect strength. If you show them that you have it, they'll get the idea.
Erwin frowned harder.
No one ever talked to me about it like that before.
I guess not, I said.
I'm scared of doing that.
Who wouldn't be? I asked him. But the only way to beat your fears is to face them. If you don't, they're going to keep on doing this to you. And then others. And someday, someone is going to get hurt bad. It might even be those two jackasses who get hurt, if someone doesn't make them realize that they can't go through life acting like that.
They aren't really bad guys, Erwin said slowly. I mean, to anyone but me. They're okay to other people.
Then I'd say that you'd be helping them as well as yourself, Erwin.
He nodded slowly and took a deep breath. I'll think about it.
Good, I said. Thinking for yourself is the most valuable skill you'll ever learn.
Thank you, Harry, he said.
I rose and picked up my broom.
You bet.
I went back to sweeping one end of the cafeteria. Coach Pete stood at the other end. Erwin returned to his writing, and the Bully Brothers came in. They approached as before, moving between the tables, splitting up to come at Erwin from two sides. They ignored me and Coach Pete, closing in on Erwin with impatient eagerness. Erwin's pencil stopped scratching when they were both about 5 feet away from him, and without looking up, he said in a sharp, firm voice, "Stop." They did. I could see the face of only one of them, but the bully was blinking in surprise. "This is not cool," Erwin said, "and I'm not going to let you do it anymore." The brothers eyed him, traded rather feral smiles, and then each of them lunged at Erwin and grabbed an arm. They hauled him back with surprising speed and power, slamming his back onto the floor. One of them started slapping at his eyes and face, while the other produced a short length of heavy rubber tubing, jerked Erwin's shirt up, and started hitting him on the stomach with the hose. I gritted my teeth and reached for the handle of my mop, except it wasn't a mop that was poking up out of the bucket. It was my staff, a 6-foot length of oak as thick as my circled thumb and forefinger. If this was how the Bully Brothers started the beating, I didn't even want to think about what they'd do for a finale. Svartalf or not, I couldn't allow things to go any further before I stepped in. Coach Pete's dark eyes glittered at me from behind his sports magazine, and he crooked a couple of fingers on one hand in a way that no human being could have. I don't know what kind of magical energy this Svartalf was using, but he was good with it. There was a sharp crackling sound, and the water in the mop bucket froze solid in an instant, trapping my staff in place. My heart sped up. That kind of magical control was a bad, bad sign. It meant that the Svartalf was better than me, probably a lot better. He hadn't used a focus of any kind to help him out, the way my staff would help me focus and control my own power. If we'd been fighting with swords, that move would have been the same as him clipping off the tips of my eyelashes without drawing blood. This guy would kill me if I fought him. I set my jaw, grabbed the staff in both hands, and sent a surge of my will and power rushing down its rune-carved length into the entrapping ice. I muttered, "Forzare," as I twisted the staff, and pure energy lashed out into the ice, pulverizing it into chunks the size of gravel. Coach Pete leaned forward slightly, eager, and I saw his eyes gleam. Svartalves were old school, and their culture had been born in the time of the Vikings. They thought mortal combat was at least as fun as it was scary, and their idea of mercy only embraced killing you quickly as opposed to killing you slowly. If I started up with a Svartalf, it wouldn't be over until one of us was dead, probably me. I was afraid. The sound of the rubber hose hitting Irwin's stomach and the harsh breathing of the struggling children echoed in the large room. I took a deep breath, grabbed my staff in two hands, and began drawing in my will once more. And then Bigfoot Irwin roared,
"I said no!"
The kid twisted his shoulders in an abrupt motion and tossed one of the brothers away as if he weighed no more than a soccer ball. The bully flew 10 feet before his butt hit the ground. The second brother was still staring in shock when Bigfoot Irwin sat up, grabbed him by the front of his shirt, and rose. He lifted the second brother's feet off the floor and simply held him there, scowling furiously up at him. The bully brothers had inherited their predatory instinct from their supernatural parent. Bigfoot Irwin had gotten something else. The second brother stared down at the younger boy and struggled to wriggle free, his face pale and frantic. Irwin didn't let him go.
"Hey, look at me," Irwin snarled. "This is not okay. You were mean to me. You kept hurting me for no reason. That's over now. I'm not going to let you do it anymore, okay?"
The first brother sat up shakily from the floor and stared agog at his former victim, now holding his brother effortlessly off the floor.
"Did you hear me?"
Irwin asked, giving the kid a little shake. I heard his teeth clack together.
Yeah,
stammered the dangling brother, nodding emphatically.
"I hear you. I hear you. We hear you."
Irwin scowled for a moment. Then he gave the second brother a push before releasing him. The bully fell to the floor 3 feet away and scrambled quickly back from Irwin. The pair of them started a slow retreat.
"I mean it," Irwin said. "What you've been doing isn't cool. We'll figure out something else for you to do for fun, okay?"
The bully brothers mumbled something vaguely affirmative and then hurried out of the cafeteria. Bigfoot Irwin watched them go. Then he looked down at his hands, turning them over and back as if he'd never seen them before. I kept my grip on my staff and looked down the length of the cafeteria at Coach Pete. I arched an eyebrow at him. "It seems like the boys sorted this out on their own." Coach Pete lowered his magazine slowly. The air was thick with tension, and the silence was its hard surface. Then the Svartalf said,
"Your sentences, Mr. Pounder."
"Yes, sir, Coach Pete," Irwin said. He turned back to the table and sat down, and his pencil started scratching at the paper again. Coach Pete nodded at him, then came over to me. He stood facing me for a moment, his expression blank. "I didn't intervene," I said. "I didn't try to dissuade your boys from following their natures. Irwin did that." The Svartalf pursed his lips thoughtfully and then nodded slowly. "Technically accurate. And yet you still had a hand in what just happened. Why should I not extract retribution for your interference?"
"Because I just helped your boys."
"In what way?" "Irwin and I taught them caution. That's some praise too much for them to handle. And we didn't even hurt them to make it happen." Coach Pete considered that for a moment and then gave me a faint smile. "A lesson best learned early rather than late." He turned and started to walk away.
"Hey,"
I said in a sharp, firm voice. He paused.
"You took the kid's book today," I said. "Please return it."
Irwin's pencil scratched along the page, suddenly loud. Coach Pete turned, then he pulled the paperback in question out of his pocket and flicked it through the air. I caught it in one hand, which probably made me look a lot more cool and collected than I felt at the time. Coach Pete inclined his head to me a little more deeply than before.
"Wizard."
I mirrored the gesture.
"Svartalf?"
He left the cafeteria, shaking his head. What sounded suspiciously like a chuckle bubbled in his wake. I waited until Irwin was done with his sentences, and then I walked him to the front of the building, where his maternal grandmother was waiting to pick him up.
"Was that okay?"
he asked me.
"I mean, did I do right?"
"Asking me if I thought you did right isn't the question," I said. Irwin suddenly smiled at me.
"Do I think I did right?"
He nodded slowly.
I think I do."
"How's it feel?" I asked him.
"It feels good. I feel not happy, satisfied, whole."
"That's how it's supposed to feel," I said. "Whenever you've got a choice, do good, kiddo. It isn't always fun or easy, but in the long run, it makes your life better." He nodded, frowning thoughtfully.
"I'll remember."
"Cool," I said. He offered me his hand very seriously, and I shook it. He had a strong grip for a kid.
"Thank you, Harry. Could I ask you a favor?"
"Sure."
"If you see my dad again, could you tell him I did good?"
"Of course," I said. "I think what you did will make him very proud." That all but made the kid glow.
And tell him that I'd like to meet him, you know, someday."
"Will do," I said quietly. Bigfoot Irwin nodded at me. Then he turned and made his gangly way over to the waiting car and slid into it. I stood and watched until the car was out of sight. Then I rolled my bucket of ice back into the school so that I could go home.
4A Wizardry. This next story is set just after the events, I believe, of Proven Guilty, where Harry Dresden has become impressed with the need to instruct the younger wizards around him. I can just barely remember the actual writing of this tale, which probably means it happened around a move. I find moving homes to be among the more hideous experiences in life, and I tend to block out several days around the experience just to be safe. If I was writing during that window, then I imagine that the story was likely late as well and absolutely needed to be finished. So, once again, I met with inspiration at the corner of late and hurry up. I wanted to write a story that began to show Dresden in his role as a teacher and mentor to the younger wizards, showing him taking on more responsibility in his community and becoming more of a leader as he grew as a wizard and as a person. He had added responsibilities now, including an apprentice of his own, and wasn't ever really going to be able to go back to the carefree days of being a roaming knight-errant. So here he's trying to impress upon the younger wizards the danger of arrogance. Something, let's face it, that Dresden has flirted with upon multiple occasions, often to his chagrin. But this is a story in which we see Dresden beginning to grow into new roles and new responsibilities, while simultaneously catching a glimpse of his past.
The first thing I thought, looking at the room full of baby wardens, was, they all look so darn young. The close second was, my God, am I getting old? "Okay, children," I said, closing the door behind me. I had rented an alleged conference center in a little Chicago hotel not too far from the airport, which amounted to a couple of rooms big enough for 20 or 30 people, if they were friendly, plus a few dozen chairs and several rickety old folding tables. They didn't even provide a cooler of water, just directions to their vending machines. After my fellow warden commander in the United States, Warden Ramirez, and I had gotten done learning the little warden-kind up on their mayhem, for the sake of getting them killed in a war as quickly as possible, we thought it might be nice to give them a little instruction in other things, too. Ramirez was going to cover the course on relations with mortal authorities, which made sense. Ramirez got on just fine with the cops in L.A. and hadn't been shot by nearly as many law enforcement personnel as I had. The kids had all come to Chicago to learn about independent investigation of supernatural threats from me, which also made sense, because I'd done more of that, relative to my tender years, than any other wizard on the planet. Okay, I said to the room. The young wardens became silent and attentive at once.
No shock there. The disruptive ones, who didn't pay attention during lessons, had mostly been killed and maimed in the war with the Red Court. Darwin always thought that it paid to be a quick learner. The war had simply made the penalty for not learning quite a bit steeper. "You're here," I said, "to learn about investigating supernatural threats on your own. You'll be learning about finding and hunting warlocks from Captain Lucio whenever the Reds give us enough time for it. Warlocks, our own kind gone bad, aren't the most common opponent you'll find yourself facing. Far more often, you're going to run up against other threats." Eliana, a young woman with extremely pale skin and ice-blue, nearly white eyes, raised her hand and spoke in a clipped Russian accent when I nodded to her.
"What kind of threats?" she asked. "In a practical sense, what foes have you faced?"
I held up my hands and flipped up a finger for each foe. Demons, werewolves, ghosts, fairies, fallen angels, black court vampires, red court vampires, white court vampires, cultists, necromancers. I paused to waggle one foot, standing with three limbs in the air. Zombies, specters, phobophages, half-blood scions, Jan. I waved my hands and foot around a bit more. I'd need to borrow a few people to do the whole list. You get the picture? A few smiles had erupted at my antics, but they sobered up after a moment's consideration. I nodded and stuck my hands into my pockets. Knowledge is quite literally power and will save your life. When you know what you're facing, you can deal with it. Walk into a confrontation blind, and you're begging to get your families added to the warden's death benefits list. I let that sink in for a few seconds before continuing. You can't ever be sure what you're going to come up against, but you can be sure about how to approach the investigation. I turned to the old blackboard on the wall behind me and scribbled on it with the stub of a piece of chalk. "I call it the four A's," I said, and wrote four A's down on the left side of the board. Granted, it doesn't translate as neatly to other languages, but you can make up your own native tongue mnemonic devices later. I used the first A to spell ascertain. "Ascertain," I said firmly. "Before you can deal with the threat, you've got to know that it exists, and you've got to know who the threat's intended target is. A lot of times that target is going to cry out for help. Whatever city you're based in, it's going to be your responsibility to work out how best to hear that scream. But sometimes there's no outcry. So keep your eyes and ears open, kids. Ascertain the threat. Become aware of the problem." My car didn't make it all the way to Kansas City. It broke down about 30 miles short of town, and I had to call a wrecker. I had planned on being there before dark, but between walking 11 miles to find an increasingly rare payphone, dumping most of my cash into a tow truck driver's pocket, and the collapse of an office computer network that delayed picking up a rental car for an extra hour and a half, I wound up pulling to the curb of a residential address a couple of minutes before 9 in the evening. I'd gotten the address from a contact on the Paranet. The organization, made up mostly of men and women who didn't have enough magical power to be accepted into the ranks of the White Council or to protect themselves from major predators, but who had more than enough mojo to make them juicy targets. For the past year, I and others like me had been working hard to teach them how to defend themselves, and one of the first things they were to do was notify someone upstream in the Paranet's organization that they were in trouble. One such call had been bucked up to me, and here I was, answering. Before I'd closed the door of the car, a spare, tense-looking man in his 40s came out of the house and walked quickly toward me. "Harry Dresden?" he called. "Yeah," I said. "You're late." "Car trouble," I said. "Are you Yardley?" He stopped across the hood of the car from me, frowning severely. He was average height and wore most of a business suit, including the tie. His black hair was cut into a short brush. He looked like the kind of guy who solved his problems through ferocious focus and mulish determination, and who tolerated no nonsense along the way. "I'm Yardley," he said. "Can you show me some ID?" I almost smiled. "You want to see my American Association of Wizards card?" Yardley didn't smile. Your driver's license will do. If I were a shapeshifter, I said, passing him the license, this wouldn't help. Yardley produced a little UV flashlight and shone it onto the license. I'm more concerned about a simple con man. He passed me the license back. I'm not really into my sister's group, whatever they are. But she's had it rough lately, and I'm not going to see her hurt anymore, do you understand? Most big brothers stop making threats about their little sisters after high school. I must be remedial, Yardley said. If you abuse Megan in any way, you'll answer to me. I felt my mouth lift up on one side. You're a cop. Detective Lieutenant, he said. I asked Chicago PD for their file on you. They think you're a fraud. And you don't, he grunted. Megan doesn't. I learned a long time ago that a smart man doesn't discount her opinion out of hand. He stared at me with hard and opaque eyes, and I realized in a flash of insight that the man was tense because he was operating on unfamiliar ground. You couldn't read it in his face, but it was there if you knew what to look for. A certain set of the shoulders, a twitch along the jawline, as if some part of him was ready to whirl around and sink his teeth into a threat that he could feel creeping up behind him. Yardley was afraid. Not for himself, maybe, but the man was terrified. Megan says shrinks can't help with this one, he said quietly. She says maybe you can. Let's find out, I said. Second day, I said to the wardenlets, writing on the chalkboard as I did. Analysis. How do you get an ogre to lie down on the couch, Harry? Called a young man with the rounded vowels of a northern accent in his speech. The room quivered with the laughter of young people. That's enough out of you there, Mackenzie, hoser. I shot back in a parody of the same accent. Give me a break here, eh? I got a bigger laugh than the heckler. Which is how you make sure the heckler doesn't steal the show from you. Pipe down, I said, and waited for them to settle. Thank you. Your second step is always analysis. Even when you know what you're dealing with, you've got to know why it's happening. If you've got an angry ghost, it's generally angry for a reason. If a new pack of ghouls has moved in down the block, they've generally picked their spot for a reason. Ileana raised her hand again, and I pointed at her. What does it matter? She asked. Ghost or ghoul is causing problems. Still, we are dealing with them, yes? She pointed her finger like a gun and dropped her thumb like the weapon's hammer on the word dealing. If you're stupid, yeah, I said. She didn't look pleased at my response. I used to have a similar attitude, I said. I held up my left hand. It was a mass of old scars and not the pretty kind. It had been burned, and badly, several years before. Wizards heal up better than regular folks over the long term. I could move it again, and I had feeling back in parts of all the fingers, but it still wasn't a pretty picture. An hour or two of work would have told me enough about the situation I was walking into to let me avoid this. I told them it was the truth, pretty much. Learn everything you possibly can. Ileana frowned at me. Mackenzie raised his hand, frowning soberly, and I nodded at him. Learn more, okay. How? I spread my hands. Never let yourself think you know all the ways to learn, I said. Expand your own knowledge base. Read. Talk to other wizards. Hell, you might even go to school. That got me another laugh. I went on before it gathered much momentum. Warren Canuck there was onto something earlier, too. People are people. Learn about what makes them tick. Monsters are the same way. Find ways to emulate their thinking. I wasn't even going to try a phrase like get into their heads, thank you. And you'll have insight into their actions and their probable intentions. Information gathering spells can be darned handy, I continued. But if you'll forgive the expression, they aren't magic. The information you get from them can be easily misread, and it will almost never let you see past one of your own blind spots. You can seek answers from other planes, but if you go bargaining with supernatural beings for knowledge, things can get dangerous fast. Sometimes what you get from them is invaluable. Most of the time, it could be had another way. Approach that particular well with extreme caution. To emphasize those last two words, I stared slowly around the room in pure challenge, daring anyone to disagree with me. The young people dropped their eyes from mine. Eye contact with a wizard is tricky. It can trigger a soul gaze, and that isn't the kind of thing you want happening to you casually. Honestly, I said into the silence, letting my voice become gentler, more conversational. The best thing you can do is communicate. Talk to the people involved. Your victims, if they can speak to you. Their family, witnesses, friends. Most of the time, everything you need is something they already know. Most of the time, that's the fastest, safest, easiest way to get it. Mackenzie raised his hand again, and I nodded. Most of the time? He asked. That's the thing about people, I said quietly so they would pay attention. Whether it's to you, or to everyone, or just to themselves, people lie. Megan Yardley was a single mother of three. She was in her early 30s and looked it, had gorgeous red hair and bright green eyes. She and her children lived in a suburb that was more sub than urb, southeast of KC, named Peculiar. Peculiar, Missouri. You can't make these things up. Megan opened the door, nodded to her brother, looked up at me and said, "You're him. You're the wizard." Her eyes narrowed. Your car broke down, and you think the name of our town is a bad joke. She nodded like a musician who has picked up on a beat and a chord progression. And you think this probably isn't a supernatural problem. I lifted my eyebrows. You're one hell of a sensitive. She nodded. You were expecting someone who was good at cold reading. A lot of professional psychics are, I said. I smiled. So are you. She arched an eyebrow at me. There's at least a fair chance that if someone is late to what is perceived as an important appointment, that car trouble is to blame, particularly if they showed up in a rental car. Most people who hadn't grown up around a town named Peculiar would think the name was odd. I grinned at her. And gosh, a lot of professional investigators are just a tad cynical. Her expression broke and she laughed. Apparently. She turned from me and kissed her brother on the cheek. Ben? Meg? Child Services was here again today, she said, her tone neutral. Damn it, Yardley said. How's Cat? She waggled a hand in the air, but her face suddenly aged 10 years. The same. Meg, the doctors, not again, Ben, she said, closing her eyes briefly. She shook her head once, and Yardley shut his jaws with an audible click. Megan looked down at the ground for a moment, and then up at me. So, Harry Dresden, high muckety-muck of the White Council. Actually, I said, I'm a fairly low muckety-muck. Or maybe a muckety-muck militant. High muckety-mucks wouldn't come to Peculiar. You're really into interruption, aren't you? I said, smiling. I was going to say they wouldn't have a problem with their car. Oh, God, she said. I think I like you.
Give it time, I said.
She nodded slowly. Then she said, with gentle emphasis, Please come into my home. She stepped back and I came into the little house, crossing over the threshold, the curtain of gentle, powerful energy that surrounds every home. Her invitation meant that the curtain parted for me, letting me bring my power with me. I exhaled slowly, tightening my metaphysical muscles and feeling my power put a silent, invisible strain on the air around me. Megan inhaled suddenly, sharply, and took a step back from me. Ah, I said, you are a sensitive. She shook her head once and then held up her hand to forestall her brother. Ben, it's fine, she looked at me again, her expression pensive, fragile. He's the real deal. We sat down in the little living room. It was littered with children's toys. The place didn't look like an animal pit, just busy and well-loved. I sat in a comfy chair. Megan perched at the edge of her couch. Yardley hovered, evidently unable to bring himself to sit. So, I said quietly, you think something is tormenting your daughters? She nodded. How old are they? Kat is 12, Tamara is 4. Uh-huh, I said. Tell me about what happens. Sometimes I seem to have the damnedest sense of timing. No sooner had I asked the question than a high-pitched scream cut the air, joined an instant later by another one. Oh, God, Megan said, and flew up to her feet and out of the room. I followed her, but more slowly, as the screaming continued. She hurried down a short hallway to a room with a trio of large cartoon girl figures I didn't recognize. They had freaking huge eyes, though. Megan emerged a moment later, carrying a dark-haired moppet in pink and white-striped footy pajamas. The little girl was clinging to her mother with all four limbs and kept screaming, her eyes squeezed tight shut. The sound was heart-wrenching. She was terrified. I had to stop short as Megan immediately took two quick steps toward me and plunged through the next doorway. This one had a poster of a band of young men on it I didn't recognize. One looked rebellious and sullen, one wacky and light-hearted, one sober and stable, and one handsomely vogue. Another monkey's reincarnation, basically. I went to the door and saw Megan, with her clinging moppet, sit down on the bed and start gently shaking the shoulder of a girl with hair like her mother's, presumably Kat. She was screaming, too, but she broke out of it a moment later, the instant her eyes fluttered open. The moppet, presumably Tamara, stopped screaming, too, and at exactly the same time. Then they both burst into less hysterical tears and clung to their mother. Megan's face was anguished, but her voice and her hands were gentle as she touched them, spoke to them, reassured them. If she was an empath as sensitive as her file and her reaction to my test suggested, then she had to be in terrible psychic pain. She pushed enough of it aside to be there for her kids, though. Damn it, I heard Yardley breathe from the hall behind me. It was a tired oath. Interesting, I said. Excuse me. I turned and paced down the hallway to the younger child's room, and nearly tripped over a dark-haired child, a boy who might have been 8. He was wearing underwear and a t-shirt with a cartoon Jedi Knight on it, which raised my opinion of his mother immediately. The kid's eyes weren't even open, and he raised his arms blindly. I picked him up and carried him with me into the little bedroom. It wasn't large. Nothing about Megan's house was. One of the beds was pink and festooned with the same 3 big-eyed girls. The other was surrounded in a plastic shell of a Star Wars land speeder. I plopped the young Jedi back into it, and he promptly curled into a ball and went to sleep. I covered him up with a blanket and turned to examine the rest of the room. Not much to it. A lot of toys, most of them more or less put away. A dresser the two younger kids evidently shared, a little table and chairs and a closet. A nice, shadowy closet. I grunted and got on the floor to peer beneath the little pink bed. Then I squinted at the closet. If I were 4 and lying on the girl's bed, the closet would be looming right past the ends of my toes. I closed my eyes for a moment and reached out with my wizard's senses, feeling the flow and ebb of energy through the house. Within the defensive wall of the threshold, other energy pulsed and moved. Emotions from the house's inhabitants. Random energies sifting in from outdoors. The usual. But not in the closet. There wasn't anything at all in that closet. Ah, I said. 3rd A, I said, writing on the board. Assemble. Avengers, said Mackenzie. Assemble, crowed the young wardens in unison. They're good kids. That is, in fact, one potential part of this phase of the investigation, I said, taking the conversation back in hand as I nodded my approval. Sometimes, once you've figured out what's going on, you go and round up reinforcements. But what assembling really means, for our purposes, is putting everything together. You got your information. Now you need to decide what to do with it. You plan what steps you need to take. You work out the possible consequences of your actions. Here's where you use your brain. If the foe has a weakness, you figure out how to exploit it. If you've got an advantage of terrain, you figure out how to use it. If you need specialized gear or equipment to help, here's where you get it. I started passing a stack of papers around the room. There's recipes on these handouts for a couple of the most common things you'll use. An antidote for red quart venom, which you're familiar with, and an ointment for your eyes that'll let you see through most fairy glamour, which you may not know about. Get used to making these. I took a deep breath. This is also the stage where sometimes you do some math. The room was very quiet for a moment. Yeah, I said. Here's where you decide whose life to risk, or whose isn't worth risking. Here's where you decide who you can save and who has already gone past saving. I've been doing this sort of thing for a while. Some of my seniors in the council would call me foolish or arrogant, and they could be right, but I've never met anyone who was breathing who I thought was too far gone to help. You've got a boogeyman, I told Megan an hour later. Megan frowned at me. A boogeyman, I said. Sometimes known as a boggle or a bogart. It's a weak form of phobophage, a fear eater, mostly insubstantial. This one is pretty common, feeds on a child's fear. Yardley's eyebrows tried to climb into his hair. That isn't possible, Megan said. I'd sense something like that. I'd feel it. I've felt things like that before. Several ghosts, once a poltergeist. Not this one. I said, you're too old. She cocked an eyebrow at me. Excuse me? I mean, you're an adult. I don't understand, she said. Only kids can sense them, I said. Part of their nature conceals them from older awarenesses. The threshold, Meg said. It should keep such things out. Sometimes they ride in with someone in the family. Sometimes if a child has a vivid enough dream, it can open up a window in the never-never that the bogart uses to skip in. They can use mirrors sometimes, too. Never-never? Yardley asked. The spirit world, I clarified.
Oh, what bullshit! Meg!
Yardley said. Megan stood up, her eyes blazing.
Benjamin!
The tension between them crackled silently in the air for several seconds.
Crap!
He snarled finally and stalked out the front door. He let it slam behind him. Megan stared at the door, her lips tight. Then she turned back to me.
If what you say is true, then how can you sense it? She asked.
I can't, I said. That was the giveaway. The rest of your house feels normal. The closet in the younger kid's room is a black hole.
Jesus. Meg said, turning. Tamara and Joey are asleep in there.
Relax, I said. They're safe for now. It already ate tonight. It isn't going to do it again. And it can't physically hurt them. All it can do is scare them.
All it can do? Megan asked. Do you have any idea what they've gone through?
She says she never even remembers waking up screaming, but Kat's grades are down from straight A's to C's. She hasn't slept a solid night in 6 months. Tamara stopped talking. She doesn't say more than a dozen words a day.
Her eyes shone, but she was too proud to let me see tears fall.
Don't tell me my children aren't being hurt.
I winced and held up my hands, placatingly. You're right, okay. I'm sorry. I picked the wrong words. I took a deep breath and exhaled. The point is that now that we know about it, we can do something.
We?
It will be better if someone in the family helps with the exorcism, yeah.
Exorcism? She asked.
She stared at the doorway Yardley had gone out.
Sure, I said. It's your house, not the boogeyman's.
If I show you how, are you willing to kick that thing's ass?
Yes,
she said. Her voice was hard. Might be dangerous, I said. I've got your back, but there's always a risk. You sure? Megan turned to face me, and her eyes blazed.
Yeah, I said. That's what I thought.
Last day, I said, writing. Act.
That seems obvious, Ileana said.
Sure, I said. but it's where everything gets decided, and it's always a gamble. You're betting that you've seen everything clearly, that you know everything that's going on.
Yes, Ileana said, her tone somewhat exasperated. That is the purpose of the first three as.
A's, Mackenzie corrected her absently. Eh? Ileana speared him with an icy gaze.
Whatever. We are discovering what is happening. That was the point of the methodology.
Ah, I said, lifting a finger. But do we know everything? Are you so sure you know exactly what's happening? Especially when you're about to put the safety of yourself or others on the line?
Ileana looked confused.
Why would I not be sure?
I smiled faintly. The next evening, the children went to bed at 9. They stopped asking for drinks, searching for the next day's clothing, waving glow-in-the-dark lightsabers in the air, and otherwise acting like children by 9:30. They were all sleeping by 9:35. Megan, a surly Yardley, and I immediately got ready to ambush the boogeyman. While Megan collected clipped hairs from her children's heads, Yardley and I cleared off enough carpet for me to take a container of salt and pour it out into a circle. You can use just about anything to make a magic circle, but salt is often the most practical. It's a symbol of the earth and of purity, and it doesn't draw ants. You use sugar to make a circle on the carpet only once, let me tell you. Megan returned, and I nodded toward the circle. In there. She went over to the circle, being careful not to disturb it, and dropped the locks of hair from her children, bound together by long strands of her own coppery curls, into the center. Right, I said. Meg, stand in the circle with them. She took a deep breath and then did it, turning to face the open, darkened closet. Her breathing was slow, but not steady. She was smart enough to be scared. Remember what I said, I told her quietly. When you feel it on you, close that circle and think of your children. She nodded tightly. I'm right here, I told her. It gets bad, I'll step in. You can do this. Right, she said in a very thin voice. I nodded to her, trying to look calm and confident. She needed that. Then I stepped back out into the hallway. Yardley came with me and closed the door behind him, leaving Megan and her children in the dark.
I don't get it, he said in a low, quiet voice. How's it supposed to help the kids if they're asleep?
I gave him a look. By destroying the creature that's attacking them? His lips twisted sourly.
It's a prophylactic effect thing, right?
Placebo effect, I sighed, and no, it isn't.
Because there's a real monster, he said.
I nodded. Sure. He eyed me for a while.
You're serious. You believe it?
Yep. Yardley looked like he wanted to sidle a few more feet away from me. He didn't.
How's this supposed to work? He asked.
The kid's hair is going to substitute for them, I said. As far as the boogeyman is concerned, the hairs are the children. Like using a set of clothes you've worn to leave a false trail for something following your scent. Yardley frowned.
Okay.
Your sister's hair is bound around them, I said, binding her to the kids. She's close to them, obviously loves them. That's got a kind of power in it. She's going to be indistinguishable from the children to the boogeyman.
She's a decoy?
She's a damn landmine, I said. Boogeymen go after children because they're weak. Too weak to stand up to an adult mind and will. So, once this thing gets into the circle, she closes it and tears it to shreds.
Then why is she afraid? He asked.
Because the boogeyman has power. It's going to tear at her mind. It'll hurt. If she falters, it might be able to hurt her bad. Yardley just stared at me for a long, silent moment. Then he said,
You aren't a con man. You believe it.
Yeah, I said, and leaned back against the wall. It might be a long wait.
I don't know what's scarier, Yardley said. If you're crazy, or if you're not. Kids are sensitive, I said. They'll take the lead from their mom. If mom is scared and worried, they will be too. If it helps, think of this as my way of giving the kids a magic feather. Yardley frowned, and then nodded, like Dumbo. Yep, I said. Couple months from now, that'll be the easiest way to understand it. He let out a short, bitter bark of laughter. Yeah, definitely. You do this a lot. Yep. We waited in silence for about half an hour. Then Yardley said, I work violent crimes. I turned my head to look at him. I help my sister set up out here in Peculiar to get her away from the city. Make sure her kids are safe, you know? I hear you. I've seen bad things, Yardley said quietly. It scares the hell out of me to think of my nieces, my nephew, becoming another one of the pictures in my head. I nodded and listened. I worked this case last week, Yardley said a moment later. Wife and kids got beaten a lot. Our hands were tied. Couldn't put this guy away. One night he goes too far with a knife, kills the wife, one of the kids, leaves the other one with scars all over her face. His own face turned pale. And now, this is happening. The kids are falling apart. Child Protective Services is going to take them away if something doesn't change. I grunted. I grew up in the system, I said. Orphan. He nodded. Something's going to change, I said. He nodded again, and we went silent once more. Sometime between 11:30 and midnight, a scream erupted from the older kid's room. Yardley and I both looked up, blinking. Cat, he said. What the hell? I muttered. A few seconds later, the little girl started screaming, that same painfully high-pitched tone I'd heard the night before. And then Megan started screaming, too. Damn it, Yardley said. He drew his gun and was a step behind me as I pushed open the door to Joey and Tamara's room. Megan was crouched in the circle of salt, swaying. The lights were flickering on and off. As I came in, Joey sat up with a wail, obviously tired and frightened. I could see something in the circle with Megan, a shadow that fled an instant after the lights came up, slower than the rest. It was about the size of a chimpanzee, and it clung to his shoulders and waist with indistinct limbs, its head moving as if ripping with fangs at her face. Megan's expression was twisted in pain and fear. I didn't blame her. Holy crap, that was the biggest boogeyman I'd ever seen. They usually weren't much bigger than a raccoon. Meg! Yardley screamed and started forward. I caught his arm. Don't break the circle, I shouted. Get the kids out of here. Get the kids! He hesitated for only a second before he seized Tamara and Joey and hauled them out of the room, one under each arm. I went to the edge of the circle and debated what to do. Damn it. What had this thing been eating? If I broke the circle, it would be free to escape, and it was freaking supercharged on the dark spiritual equivalent of adrenaline. It would fight like hell to escape and come back the next night bigger and hungrier than ever. Nasty as the thing was, Megan still ought to be able to beat it. She was a sensitive, feeling the emotions and pieces of the thoughts of others thanks to a naturally developed talent, something that would manifest as simple intuition. It would mean that she would have developed a certain amount of defensive ability just to keep from going nuts in a crowd. Megan, I said, you can beat this thing. Think of your kids. They're hurting, she screamed. I can feel them. Your brother has them. They're fine, I called back. That's a lie it's trying to push on you. Don't let it trick you. Megan glanced up at me, desperate, and I saw her face harden. She turned her face back into the shadowy salt of the flailing Bogart, and her lips peeled back from her teeth with a snarl. They're mine, she spat, the words sizzling with vitriol. My babies, and you can't touch them anymore. Be gone, I called to her. Tell it to be gone.
Be gone! Megan screamed. Be gone! Be gone!
There was a surge of sound, a thunderous non-explosion, as if all the air in the room had suddenly rushed into a ball just in front of Megan's pain-twisted face. Then there was a flash of light and a hollow-sounding scream, and a shockwave lashed out, scattering the salt of the circle, rattling toys, and pushing against my chest. I staggered back against the wall and turned my face away as a fine cloud of salt blasted out and rattled against the walls with a hiss. Megan fell to her knees and started sobbing. I reached out around me with my senses, but felt no inexplicable absence in the aura of the house. The boogeyman was gone. I went to Megan's side at once and crouched down to touch her shoulder. She flung herself against me, still sobbing. Ben Yardley appeared in the doorway to the room a few moments later. He had Joey in one arm and Tamara in the other. Cat stood so close she was practically in his pocket, holding on to the hem of his jacket as if he was her own personal teddy bear. Okay, I said quietly. It's okay. The thing's gone. Your mom stopped it. Cat stared at me for a moment, tears in her eyes, and then ran to Megan and flung herself against her mother. That drove Joey and Tamara into motion, and they both squirmed out of Yardley's arms and ran to their mother. Thank you, Megan said. She freed one hand from her children long enough to touch my arm. Wizard, thank you. I felt a little bit sick, but I gave her my best modest smile. I finished the recounting for the young wardens and let the silence fall. What was my mistake? I asked. No one said anything. I trusted the process too much, I said. I thought I had already analyzed the whole situation, found the problem, identified the source of the danger. But I was wrong. You all know what I did. What happened? No one said anything. The Bogart I'd identified wasn't the source of the attacks. It was just feeding on the fear they generated in the kids. It hadn't needed to expend any energy at all to generate nightmares and fear in them. All it had to do was feed. That's why it was so large. The source of the attacks wasn't an attack at all, I said. Ben Yardley's job had exposed him to some pretty bad things. Memories and images that wouldn't go away. Some of you who fought in the war know what I'm talking about. Mackenzie, Ileana, and a few others gave me sober nods. Cat Yardley was the eldest daughter of her mother, a fairly gifted sensitive. She was 12 years old. Damn, Mackenzie said, his eyes widening in realization.
Yes, of course,
Ileana said. The other students turned to look at her.
The eldest daughter was a sensitive too, perhaps a skilled one. She had picked up on those images in her uncle's mind and was having nightmares about them.
What about the little girl? I asked. Mackenzie took over. Cat must have been a pusher too, he said, using the slang for someone who could broadcast thoughts or emotions to others. She was old enough to be a surrogate mother to the younger daughter. They were probably linked somehow.
Exactly, Warden Mackenzie, I said quietly. All the pieces were in front of me, and I just didn't put them together. I figured the situation for a simple boogeyman infestation. I set up Megan to do the heavy lifting because I thought it would be relatively safe and would work out best for the family. I was wrong.
But it did work out,
Ileana said, something tentative in her voice, for the first time that day. You kidding? I asked. That big Bogart inflicted mental trauma on Megan that took her most of a year to recover from. She had her own nightmares for a while. I sighed. I went back to her and gave her and her daughter some exercises to do that would help insulate them both. Cat's problems improved, and everything worked out fine, but it almost didn't. If Yardley had panicked and used his gun, if someone had broken the circle, or if Megan Yardley hadn't bought my lie about the Bogart pushing a falsehood on her, it might have ripped out her sanity altogether. I might have put 3 kids into the foster care system. Arrogance, I said quietly, and wrote it down on the board beneath the rest. That's the 5th A. We carry it around with us. It's natural. We know a lot more than most people. We can do a lot more than most people. There's a natural and understandable pride in that. But when we let that pride get in the way and take the place of truly seeing what is around us, there can be horrible consequences. Watch out for that 5th A, children. The Yardleys turned out all right, mostly out of pure luck. They deserve better from me and from you. Always keep your eyes open. Learn all that you can, and then try to learn some more. I took a deep breath and then nodded. Okay, we'll break for lunch, then we'll look at another case I didn't screw up quite as badly. Back here in an hour. Dismissed. The young wardens got up and dispersed, except for Mackenzie and Ileana. The two came down to stand beside me. Commander, Mackenzie said, this girl, Kat, most of the talented mortals only demonstrate a single talent. She demonstrated at least 2. I'm aware, I said.
This girl, Ileana said, her talents were born in trauma and fear. This is one of the warning signs of a potential warlock.
Yeah, I said. My talents had started in a similar fashion. I heard that once.
So, she's under surveillance? Ileana asked.
I drop in on her once in a while, I said.
That poor kid, Mackenzie said. What do we do?
I spread my hands. It's an imperfect world, wardens. We do what we always do. I smiled at them lopsidedly. Whatever we can. They both looked down, frowning, concerned. Concerned for a little girl who had no idea of what might be waiting for her. Excellent. The lesson hadn't been wasted. Okay, guys, I said. Burger King? That perked them both up, though Ileana, benighted soul that she was, didn't react with joy at the utterance of the holy name of the Mount Olympus of fast food. We left together. You do whatever you can.
I was a teenage Bigfoot. This next story, set around the same time as Deadbeat in the main Dresden Files storyline, was written as part of correcting the injustice of not having considered Bigfoot sufficiently in my previous worldbuilding. For that reason alone, it was a totally necessary story. But I also wanted to try a tale that was a little less smash action figures together-y, which is a fair assessment of several of my short stories. So I plotted out this one, where the motives are perhaps a little less sinister and a little more dangerously human than a simple case of attacker versus defender, and to force Dresden to deal with a situation other than directly confronting some brand of bully. Also, I wanted to show Irwin growing up as well, and particularly the effect Dresden had had on his life. The idea of the consequences of your actions coming back to you in the future is ingrained into the fabric of the Dresden Files. And both your terrible choices and your more inspired ones engender consequences that will eventually come home to roost.
There are times when, as a professional wizard, my vocation calls me to the great outdoors. And that night, I was in the North Woods of Wisconsin with a mixed pack of researchers, enthusiasts, and, well, nerds.
I don't know, Matt, said a skinny kid named Nash. What's his name again?
I poked the small campfire I'd set up earlier with a stick and pretended that they weren't standing less than 10 feet away from me. The forest made forest sounds like it was supposed to. Full dark had fallen less than half an hour before.
Harry Dresden, said Gary, a plump kid with a cell phone, a GPS unit, and some kind of video game device on his belt. Supposed to be a psychic or something?
He was twiddling deft fingers over the surface of what they call a smartphone these days. Hell, the damn things are probably smarter than me.
Supposed to have helped Chicago PD a bunch of times. I'd pull up the internet references, but I can't get reception out here.
A psychic? Nash said. How is anyone ever supposed to take our research seriously if we keep showing up with fruitcakes like that?
Gary shrugged. Dr. Sinor knows him or something. Dr. Sinor had nearly been devoured by an ogre in a suburban park one fine summer evening, and I'd gotten her out